From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. So far, it's been a long road to the White House, months and months of campaigning before the primaries even started, and then a gradual winnowing of candidates as voters had their say. But it's certainly not over yet. This weekend, Barack Obama picked up delegates in Louisiana, Maine, Washington, and Nebraska, and conservative voters in Louisiana and Kansas gave Mike Huckabee the thumbs up. Tomorrow brings the Potomac primaries. NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving is here to break things down for us. Hey, Ron.
Good to be with you, Farai.
So last time we talked a lot about Super Tuesday. Nobody won convincingly. This weekend we saw a little bit more of a pattern. So what was the most significant race on the Democratic side first?
I suppose the most significant would be the one that had the most delegates. That would be Washington State. That was a caucus, and it attracted record turnout, more than double the turnout record in previous years in Washington State. And it was won convincingly, overwhelmingly, 2-1 by Barack Obama. You could also, though, say that the largest number of votes that were cast in any state over the weekend were in Louisiana, which did not have quite as big a delegate payout, but which was a primary and therefore had a larger voting base, also won by Barack Obama, although with a little less than 60%, because while he dominated the African-American vote at 86% or so, according to the exit polls, he did not do nearly as well among white voters, and that depressed his margin. Still, an easy win, almost 20 points.
What about the Republicans? What was the most significant news?
The most significant news, I think, on the Republican side was that two states, Kansas and Louisiana, shot across the bow of John McCain by saying they were not ready to endorse the idea he was the nominee. Washington State was called for John McCain with some of the vote yet to be counted and not too much of a margin for John McCain, but the state party chairman out there said they had seen enough caucus counting and they were going to award half the state's delegates to John McCain and then do the rest in a primary that's coming up in a few weeks. Now, that's already been protested by the Huckabee campaign, which was hoping to get a sweep, like Barack Obama, of all the events on the ballot on Saturday for the Republicans.
So parse out for us this delegate situation on the Democratic side. What's the state of play right now in terms of who has how many?
Well, it's a big scoreboard, and there are a lot of different numbers on it, and they do move around a fair amount. But let's start with the ones that are pretty certain and aren't going to change. That's the number of pledged delegates won so far. These are the delegates that are allocated to each candidate on the basis of the results of each primary or caucus. So in this station, and where we stand now, Hillary Clinton has 893 from all the states that have voted so far on the Democratic side, and Barack Obama has 952. So he is open to lead there of almost 60 delegates among the pledged delegates. Now, of course, as we've been saying right along through this campaign, there is another category of delegate. It amounts to about 20% of the overall number of delegates going to the National Convention in Denver, and we call them superdelegates. That's an informal term. They have been created over the years by the Democratic Party to be something of a counterweight and to keep the, if you will, party officialdom in the game. So if you're a member of Congress or you're a member of the Democratic National Committee or you're a Democratic governor, you are automatically a delegate to the convention, and they call them superdelegates. Now, among this group, and again, it's roughly 800 overall, here Hillary Clinton has a lead of 243 to 156 for Obama. So if you do the math, she is still ahead overall, 1,136 to 1,108.
Man, you know, good thing I stuck with the math in college. Anyway, so let's move on to what could be more winning and losing math. D.C., Maryland, Virginia go to the polls tomorrow. All three have significant African-American populations. So are these states and the district leaning towards Obama?
Yes, they are. We expect the District of Columbia not to be close. That's for 15 delegates. That is a black-majority city, and the District of Columbia is the city of Washington. Then there's Maryland, and Maryland is increasingly dominated by three of its polities. The city of Baltimore, of course, and on the Democratic side, the city is the most important part. Then here in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., we have Prince George's County, which is a majority African-American county, and we also have Montgomery County, which is of mixed race but does have a very large proportion of higher income people whose living is usually in some sense or another associated with the federal government, and it tends to also vote very Democratic. All three of these jurisdictions are expected to go substantially for Barack Obama. So Maryland should not be a problem for him.
What about Virginia, which has, you know, it's this intersection of sometimes Democratic politics and sometimes Republican and conservative politics?
Yes, indeed. Well, here we have the state of Virginia, which is, of course, famous as the capital of the Confederacy. This is the state where massive resistance was the policy in the 1950s in resisting school desegregation. It is a state where the old Dixiecrat Democratic Party kind of fell apart in the years after integration began, in the years after the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act in the middle 60s, and where a new Democratic Party has been built in its place, based on African-American voters, also on white suburban voters in Northern Virginia in the Washington, D.C. suburbs, and on traditional Democratic voters around the state who have moved back into the Democratic Party for reasons usually of economic issues. Now, that voting bloc has strengthened in recent years and has, for example, been responsible for electing a Democratic senator in Jim Webb last November, and previous to that, rather in November of 2006, and also a Democratic governor, Tim Kaine. And Tim Kaine has thrown his operation, his political assets, behind Barack Obama in Virginia, where he's also very popular among the African-Americans in the Tidewater area and in the Richmond area and in the Washington, D.C. suburbs. He has a substantial polling lead in Virginia as well, Farai.
Now, going back to the delegate question, Mitt Romney had a significant number of delegates. What happens to his delegates on the Republican side? Who gets to choose what pile they get thrown in?
He had 282 pledged delegates when he got out of the race last Thursday, bowing out to John McCain. But he did not actually totally 100% leave the campaign. He suspended his campaign, which means he's no longer really contesting John McCain's nomination. But if something should happen, some untoward event were to really alter the course of things in the next couple of weeks or months, or as we get closer to the convention, if something happened to John McCain and Mitt Romney wanted to get back into the fray, he's still holding on to that cache of delegates, which is at this point still the second largest. He's still a little bit ahead Mike Huckabee, even though Huckabee had a pretty good weekend out there. So Mitt Romney's hanging on to those delegates for now. In the end, we expect there will not be a big fight for the nomination at the convention, and all the delegates will make it unanimous for John McCain, except those few who might choose to cast a kind of protest vote.
All right. Well, Ron, thanks again.
Thank you, Farai.
NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving joined us from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. And now we're going to dig into another issue reshaping the political landscape, those superdelegates. To put it simply, superdelegates have superpowers. Many are high-ranking party and elected officials. Unlike the delegates selected through primaries, they can go to a party convention and make up their own minds about who to vote for. About one in five Democratic delegates is a superdelegate, including frequent News and Notes contributor Donna Brazile. Hey, how you doing?
I'm great. I'm still super.
Yeah, you're always super. And you said on CNN, if 795 of my colleagues decide this election, I will quit the Democratic Party. Now, you, of all people, have shown a loyalty to Democratic politics. You have been helping out since you were a little girl in politics. You managed the candidacy of former Vice President Al Gore. Would you really quit the party?
Oh, absolutely. I will quit the position I currently hold on the DNC as a superdelegate, that is, an at-large member of the Democratic National Committee, as well as the chair of the Voting Rights Institute. Let me tell you why I feel so strongly. And I respect my 795 colleagues. They have earned their seat at the table. They are governors. They are members of Congress, House and Senate. Barack Obama is a superdelegate. Hillary Clinton is a superdelegate. Former President Bill Clinton is a superdelegate. We also have activists, party leaders, teachers, organizers. I mean, we come from all walks of life, from all regions of the country. And yes, we're black, white, gay, straight, we're old, we're disabled, we're veterans. I mean, I can name it because they represent the depth and breadth of the diversity of the Democratic Party. But I think at this moment, we're in a virtual tie. And a historic election with two equally compelling, interesting candidates. I don't have a favorite. I love them both. Tomorrow I will cast a vote in the District of Columbia. That vote is my vote. But the vote that I cast as superdelegate, since I'm uncommitted, should reflect the will of the people. It should also help the party determine who is the best candidate to become president if we end up in a tie.
Well, Donna, let me just ask this flat out. What other options are there? I mean, what are you suggesting the solution is other than having people who have these exalted positions make the decision
on their own? Here's what I'm concerned about. This past weekend, the voters in Louisiana participated. The voters in Nebraska participated. Why don't we allow the voters in Maryland, Virginia, D.C., Pennsylvania, Ohio, Texas, Mississippi, North Carolina, Indiana, Oregon, and I can continue to go on and on. Give them a chance to weigh in on this decision. They may break the tie. They may decide that, you know what, they can make this decision without the superdelegates, you know, crowning a queen or a king prematurely. All I'm saying is let's not end the process. What I was worried about after Super Tuesday is that all of the analysis started focusing on the 796 party makers. We represent only 20% of the convention. 80% of the convention will be selected by people at the grassroots level, pledged delegates. Let's see if they can decide this before we throw our weight and stop the process. Now, I know that as a party, we have to deal with the two states that did not comply with the rules, Michigan and Florida. That should be on the table for discussion at some point, whether it's now when the Rules Committee could reconsider their sanctions, or it could be later when the Credentials Committee have to decide if they will seat some folks from those two states. But at this point, as superdelegates, all I'm saying is that if we have not committed, let's wait for some of these other states to, you know, sort of help sort this out. And by the way, this is one of the most exciting elections I've ever seen. I never thought I would see an election like this. People were standing out in the cold and the wet snow yesterday in Maine to cast their vote. Let's give these people a chance to vote. And if we cannot sort it out, then we'll go back to the rules, and the rules state that superdelegates also count.
Well, Donna, stay with us. We're going to come back to you after the break. We're talking with Donna Brazil, News and Notes contributor, as well as multifaceted political analyst, about the politics of primaries, superdelegates, and brokered conventions. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We're back with Donna Brazil, and we're talking about superdelegates and how they could shape the Democratic nominee for president. Donna is a superdelegate. She's also a Democrat, and she's uniquely qualified to speak on those issues for that reason. Donna, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I understand you told the New York Times that basically your niece, among 9 million other people, has been lobbying you. What does it feel like to get that? First of all, how did your niece call up and you know, did she know that you were a superdelegate? And what about all the other people who were calling you up? What do you say to them?
Well, first of all, I'm flattered by the amount of attention that we're all are getting, not just the superdelegates, but those who are out there running for pledged delegate today across the country. Look, Democrats are hungry for a victory. They want change. They are tired of George Bush, and they don't want to see four more years of Bush-Cheney. So I think that's the reason why we see such high levels of enthusiasm. My niece, Jay Mallory, is going to graduate from Southern University this spring. And when she called me and said, Auntie Donna, are you a superdelegate? I see your name on this list, and I don't know how our names, but we are public. There's no such thing as, secret list. Everyone knows who we are. We're governors, we're members of Congress, as I mentioned before, and we're party leaders and activists. She was calling because she intended to vote on Saturday in Louisiana, and she wanted to make sure that I somehow or another represented her voice and her vote, and I thanked her for her call, and I also encouraged her to get out on time from school. But I would love to see a process by which we allow as many voters as possible, and maybe we have to go to Pennsylvania April 22nd. Perhaps we'll go as late as May in North Carolina. But I trust the voters to decide this election. I saw an election stopped by the count in the Supreme Court. I know how that feels when all of the votes are not counted. That's why I'm also raising concerns about how we address the situation in both Florida and Michigan. But as a superdelegate, I really want to make a responsible decision, and I would like to see more voters participate. I'm just speaking up for the people. I will be fine. I will always support my party, but I would like to see more people involved in the process.
When you think about these issues of how much power the parties have over decision-making versus the voters who go to the polls for the parties, do you think that the Democratic Party does not actually trust the voters?
We're a party that says that we believe in equal justice under the law. We're a party that says that we believe in fairness and equality for all citizens, regardless of their background, their race, their sexual orientation, their age, or their status in life. And therefore, if we believe in fairness and equality and justice for all, there's no reason why we should stop this process. I think Senator Obama or Senator Clinton, one of those two senators will pull out. They will either come from behind and pull out, or they will, you know, start from where they are this week and go forward. We'll see. But we have some big stakes, big states at stake, Ohio, Texas, Pennsylvania. We need those states in the fall. So I don't want it said that we had to stop the count before we reach Ohio because one of the candidates is now leading in superdelegates. Let's allow the people in Akron, Ohio, that have lost jobs to overseas. Let's let the people down in Texas, people that are worried about hurricanes, about flooding, about paying their mortgage on time, let them decide. Once they decide, I will back their wishes.
All right. On that note, Donna, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was News and Notes contributor Donna Brazile. She is a proud Democrat and author of the book Cooking with Grease, Stirring the Pots in American Politics, and she joined us from Washington, D.C. The federal stimulus package is one of those places where politics meets economics. Now that the president is poised to sign the bill, what will shake out for you and your family? And how are investors reacting to the volatile stock market? For more, I'm joined by Bill Spriggs. He's a professor and economics chair at Howard University. Hi, Bill.
Hi, thanks for having me today.
Well, so this week, the president plans to sign this economic stimulus bill. It could give wage earners up to $600 plus parents up to $300 per child. So how will this affect people in the short run and the long run?
Well, in the short run, it'll help to shore up the economy. We saw that consumers weren't making retailers very happy last month. They shied away from the stores. This money puts right in the pocket of folks who are going to spend something to help them get through this tough time. It's necessary because of the drop in consumption.
When the government is spending over $150 billion on a stimulus bill like this, will that have a long-run effect on how every person who gets a check has to pay out their taxes in the future, has to deal with the realities of how much service the federal government can give in the future? I mean, will there be a sort of back-end retax for people who might get a cut in the short run?
I wouldn't put it that way. The problem is in the short run, will people be much worse off? And will they be able to recover from that? Because during a recession, it's not unusual for families to lose 2 or 3% of their income. So the issue is, do you want to lose that 2 or 3% because in the future you don't want to get a tiny tax increase to balance the budget? So I think you have to think about what's the potential loss in income, which can be huge if we have a severe recession or even a mild recession like the one we had in 2001.
Well, I guess conversely then, I mean, if you are looking at the perspective of how much a recession could hurt, which is certainly, you know, the biggest factor here, is this enough? Is a $600 check enough? If you have a family, for example, where you qualify for two $600 checks for the parents and two $300 checks for kids, is that enough to really forestall a recession if it's looming?
Well, you have to add it in the aggregate. So it gets back to the big number, the $150 billion. And whether putting $150 billion into the marketplace is going to really offset the potential drop that we may have. In the long run, we will have some other problems. If firms continue the trend of not creating jobs, if over the last month we saw jobs lost, if they continue to cut jobs, then we're going to have some other problems. And we're going to look at unemployment insurance, something that the president and the Republicans in Congress totally denied was an issue. This past quarter, the third quarter of 2007, there were about 650,000 Americans who exhausted their unemployment benefits. We've also seen that the long-term unemployed, people unemployed more than 26 weeks because those are the ones who will exhaust their benefits. That trend has been going up, the share of unemployed workers unemployed for more than 26 weeks. So with job cuts, we're going to see more long-term unemployed. We're going to see more people exhausting their unemployment benefits. And those are folks you have to get money to right away.
You mentioned unemployment, and that was something that was originally in one version of the stimulus package, and it was left on the cutting room floor as people made their compromises. Do you think that that's going to, the failure to add more unemployment insurance is going to really undermine the efforts to keep the economy afloat?
Oh, I think it will. It was a necessary compromise because the president and the Republicans in Congress don't seem to think there's a recession coming, and were very reticent to do anything. So the compromise was to try and get as much money into the hands of middle class and working Americans to make sure that we could keep the economy afloat. But in the end, we're going to have to revisit the unemployment insurance system, which is the bulwark of our automatic safety net. It kicks in if Congress will be willing to act by letting Congress extend the benefits.
What about the whole impact of race in this socioeconomic equation? There's many times when Black Americans are viewed as the canary in the coal mine, and you see unemployment numbers rising faster in the Black community than you do in America at large. What is happening now, and what is going to unfold, do you think, in African American communities?
Well, we could see continued spikes in the Black unemployment rate. African Americans are the ones who are more likely to exhaust unemployment benefits because we are more likely to have long-term unemployment. So this is a real strain coming up for the African-American community if we continue to see job cuts take place. The unemployment rate for Blacks tends to spike early on when job growth slows, and then because we tend to be the last hired. And then when jobs actually start being cut, we start to lose because we tend to also be the first ones fired.
Give me some examples of what might happen in a place like Washington, D.C. You know, you're at Howard University, you're in the heart of Washington, D.C., and it's a very, in some ways, very much a typical African-American community-based city, in other ways, completely diverse, and both socioeconomically and racially. How do you see the core African-American neighborhoods in the district being affected potentially by some of the trends in jobs and some of the trends in the economy?
Well, D.C. is somewhat insulated because we have the federal government, which tends not to go into recession as badly. But this region has become much more prominent with the private sector, particularly the information technology industries, which heavily hire African Americans here on the East Coast and in the D.C. corridor. So it is very likely that those companies may see some job layoffs. And because African Americans are equally represented in information technology industries, both web pages and telephone communications and all of those types of things, and they are a big part of the private sector here in D.C., we will see some pain in the suburbs of Washington.
Now, the stock market is volatile. Some investors expect that they might have safer bets if they're not investing in stocks. Many of us, if not most of us, don't invest directly. But when you think about the options that are out there that are driving the economy at large, tell us a little bit about money funds.
Well, the money funds are not only fleeing the stock market, they're also fleeing the bond market. There are a number of securities that people just aren't sure of, and they are trying to avoid those that are riskier. So in addition to leaving the stock market, they're lowering the price of bonds, which is creating a bigger spread on a lot of these bonds. It makes it harder for banks to hold those as assets. And once banks start to flow out of them, pension funds start to flow out of them, the way that most of us own these things indirectly is through pension funds. It creates a real ripple effect because the banks now put themselves in a position that's slightly less liquid.
Explain what you mean by slightly less liquid.
They have less money to loan. They are revaluing their assets down, and they can't loan as much money.
So when you take a look at this exodus of some money from the stock market and even from the bond market, how does it affect people who aren't directly investing, people who may have a 401k or a pension plan, but who are not, you know, keeping track of what these big institutional banks are doing? What does that mean on a very grassroots level?
Well, during the last recession, billions, hundreds of billions of dollars went out of 401k funds as well as pension funds. And it took us about 3 years to get that money back because of the drop in the stock market value of the assets that those funds invest in. So a similar decline means hundreds of billions of dollars gone. People who would be retiring now would face much lower benefits in retirement. They may have to do as they did in 2001, hold on. We saw many people in their late 50s who did not retire in the recession of the early 2000s because their portfolios weren't worth as much money.
Let's move on to a final topic of the college loan industry. It could soon be under a microscope. And last week, the House passed legislation that would compile a list of the most expensive schools in the U.S. and how loan companies shop their services to those students. What impact would that have on student loan companies, if anything?
Well, it's going to make the business a lot more transparent so that people can see if there are conflicts of interest between universities and the loans that they are presenting to students. The direct student loan program that the federal government itself does is, of course, the cheapest way, the most efficient way for the government to support student loans. And this putting sunshine on these relationships may, in fact, encourage people and encourage universities to try their best to use the direct student loan program.
What would be the conflict of interest? What kind of situations are we talking about that exist now that might be eliminated?
Well, we found in the last couple of months that there were a number of universities where the financial aid officers were actually getting kickbacks or rebates or other favorable treatment from the loan companies if they would make specific loan companies sort of the first loan that would be pushed at students. And that type of thing, I don't think parents would have imagined was taking place. And agreeing to a loan would have been, you would have imagined, something that was just normal business. Now, a number of the more expensive universities have huge endowments and have actually moved away from offering loans. The price of a college is kind of a misleading price because at many of the leading institutions where the prices are very high, only a small share of the students actually pay that full sticker price. So you'll get some information by seeing what that price is. It's really intended for the wealthiest people in the United States who pay full freight, but many middle-income and lower-income families won't ever pay that kind of amount at some of the more elite schools that have billion-dollar endowments.
So when you take a look at what's shaking out for students, I assume that many people are really looking at this mix of, you know, Pell Grants and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, but most people are still taking loans. Is that correct?
Well, if you're not at one of those elite schools, students are still taking on loans in order to finance it, particularly if they are at state institutions. And one of the things that the bill tries to do is to rein in the movement that many states got into of pushing the cost onto the students and away from the states. So that's one of the more controversial provisions in this legislation, that states will no longer be able to just make those cuts, assuming that students will pick up the bill.
When you look around a school like yours, Howard University, long storied history, what has the school done, do you think, to make outreach to students who may not be able to pay full freight?
Well, we have a number of scholarships, and the university continues to be aggressive in trying to raise scholarship money. Howard is still a bargain when you compare it to other private universities here in Washington, much lower tuition than is common here in the Washington, D.C. area. And the university is very aware of the income difference between blacks and whites and understands that while it may be that the top 1% can pay Georgetown tuition, if you look at the white income distribution, the top 1% is not the same thing for the black income distribution.
Bill, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bill Spriggs is a professor and chair of economics at Howard University. He spoke with me from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. I'm Farai Chidea. This is News and Notes. If you've been watching TV or looked up at billboards, you probably know it's Black History Month. From advertising hamburgers, antacids, pickup trucks, this month, Black History is used to push just about anything. And some Black folks have turned against the annual celebration because of all the commercialism. We'll ask our bloggers if they're hating on Black History Month and why. Joining me now, Patrice Elizabeth Grell-Yursik, creator of Afrobella.com. Also, Nashika Washington from OurBlackFriend.com. And Robert Redding. He publishes the ReddingNewsReview.com. Hey, folks.
Hello.
Hi.
So it's a thumbs up, thumbs down, love it or hate it situation. Shortest month of the year set aside to celebrate Black History Month. And there is a recent post on the blog Lola Gets Life. She, Lola, goes off on Black History Month. Patrice, what are her main complaints?
I mean, she calls it Ghetto Month because she's saying that it's, you know, the window of it is so tiny and it's I think many African Americans who have been force-fed the same old facts throughout their school years, the concept feels like a token gesture. So I think that's where she was coming from.
What about you? Where are you coming from?
I think it's a necessary thing. I think that Black History Month, it can be very beautiful. It can also be very commercial, as you pointed out. I saw that there's a popular nudie magazine with Trina on the cover for their Black History Month issue. You know, I mean, people do misuse the concept. But I think even by criticizing it for its brevity and its corniness and its commercialization, you're hopefully also helping to come up with new ways to celebrate the accomplishments of our ancestors.
Robert, is that the problem? Is the problem just that it's not fresh enough in approach, or is the problem of having a month for everything? I mean, how, or is there no problem at all? How do you make sense of it?
Well, I think that the month is appropriate given the contribution that blacks have made traditionally to the world around, including America, which, of course, is the land we all live in. But unfortunately, I don't think it goes far enough. I think that it is a bit of a token month, and it needs to go beyond, well beyond what we see so far. I think that some people, not even in the black community, I think take it seriously. Because, you know, Oprah Winfrey and folks that we would normally say that have done tremendous things, like Martin Luther King, it goes further than that. And I don't think that the month, in terms of black people, in terms of white people, goes far enough. And I think that we can do a lot more.
Now, Nishika, one thing that comes to mind for me is whether or not the month going far enough also is political enough. I mean, the more that you commercialize things sometimes, the less you take the political implications out of them. And Black History Month has been a time when people have reexamined whether or not African Americans have fit into or opposed the prevailing political winds, for example, during the Civil Rights Movement, during slavery. There's a lot of question of how political to make a celebration of African American life. It's one thing to, you know, have Harriet Tubman, you know, next to a picture of a hamburger. It's a totally different thing to talk about her as a revolutionary. Do things need to get a little more political?
I mean, I think there's room for the political aspect to be explored within Black History Month, but I don't know that it has to be one or the other. I mean, we're a multifaceted people, and you can explore politics and culture, and all of that can be incorporated. I think the month is absolutely necessary, just for the record. We have to have a time when we're actually exploring our history and ourselves, and it's just not done on a regular basis. And, of course, it could be longer. It should be done throughout the year, but it is what it is.
Did you get your dose of black history in school as you were growing up?
I got my dose of slavery, mm-hmm. which was the extent of, and maybe some Martin Luther King, you know, thrown in for good measure. But mostly it was about slavery and everybody kind of turning around and saying, ooh, you know, what do you think about that as the only, you know, black person in the room.
Yeah. Sorry about that slavery thing.
Oops. No sorries. No apologies.
No apologies. Just moving on. Patrice, what about you? Did you get in the classroom specifically, did you get a big dose of black history?
Well, you know, I wasn't born and raised in America. I'm from Trinidad and Tobago.
Right.
So, I mean, there you study pretty much it's European history and Caribbean history. And Caribbean history is all slavery all the time. Like, we did a lot on Columbus. And, I mean, we really also got, I think, more critical on him than they do in the American school system. So as somebody who wasn't born and raised here, I do learn something new every year from all of the documentaries and the events that celebrate Black History Month. There's a lot of stuff that seems to have kind of been whitewashed from the history books.
Robert, I'm actually going to transition us to another issue unfolding during Black History Month. Gina Six, back in the headlines. Bryant Purvis arrested in Carrollton, Texas. Give us a quick debrief on that story.
Basically, what we have is, you know, of course, Mr. Purvis is one of the Gina Six, and he is 19 years old. He's been charged with a misdemeanor assault. This is after, of course, he was charged inappropriately with attempted murder of a teen when he was in Louisiana. Of course, he was moved out to Texas with his uncle, who is a Dallas Cowboy, to start a better life. And essentially, hearsay, someone told him, someone wrecked his vehicle, and he confronted the gentleman. He got hostile with the gentleman, laid his hands on the gentleman, supposedly, according to the police, admitted that he laid his hands on the gentleman. So, of course, he ends up in jail. He has to get bailed out. Now his mom is saying, you know what, this makes it look as if he was involved with, when they were saying all along in Louisiana that he wasn't involved in the attack on the white teen in Louisiana. looks as if that it makes it look as if he's guilty all along. And I think she's right. It's like we said in the piece that that we were just now discussing. Duh. Yeah, absolutely. It looks as if he is guilty here. And this is the reason why I've said all along, when we look at the Jenna situation, that this is a dog. This case is a dog. It's something that Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, and these folks should have never gotten involved in, because Michael Bell's record stinks to high heaven, and this kid's record is now in question. So what more are we going to see out of this? I think that this is really a problem.
Nashika, I'm going to throw this in a slightly different light. There was a big case that came up in the course of us doing an interview last week in New York City. Patrick Dorisman was a guy shot by the police in New York City, and Mayor Rudolph Giuliani released his juvenile records. Mm. Now, there's times when people do stupid or illegal things, and there's times when they keep doing them. Is it mixing apples and oranges to look at Purvis and this current situation and to say, well, because of it, the Gina 6 case was not what it was made out to be, and the Gina 6 defendants were not, you know, worthy of defending? Is this a case where his current behavior is casting doubt on the past, perhaps unfairly?
Well, I think it doesn't really matter whether it's casting doubt or not. The cause is worthy of defense. The cause was worthy. It will be worthy in the future. Because people have latched on to this kid, I mean, he's 19, but whatever, whether he's an adult or not, his behavior, and now using it to say, oh, well, we shouldn't have defended this issue and it wasn't worth it, and Al Sharpton shouldn't have gotten involved. I don't know. That doesn't make any sense to me. I'm not sure why we're attaching all of this. I don't even know how to describe it to this person. When his behavior is poor, are we going to follow him the rest of his life and say, oh, we shouldn't have done this because this particular person did this act subsequently? Apples and oranges, yes.
Patrice?
Yes.
Do you think that it's a situation where his current behavior is being used to cast doubt on the whole the cultural push behind Gina 6?
I mean, definitely. I think he's definitely... These kids aren't doing the case any favors. You know, it's funny. This last weekend, there was a rerun of the episode of the Salt and Pepper Show where they went to Gina to protest. I don't know if you've ever seen that one. But it took me back to the heated emotions that were swirling around the case at the time. It's definitely what happened in Gina was horrible, and it was wrong, and it was unacceptable. And the fact that there was a white tree to begin with in this day and age, you know, I am glad that I supported the cause. I mean, I am disappointed in the actions of this kid. And I hope that, I mean, you would think that being one of the Gina 6 would be a really transformative experience. And I hope that he's going to learn from his mistakes. He seems pretty young and immature right now, I got to say. He's not doing it any favors.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and press on to another topic, Cynthia McKinney. It's hard to dodge the whole issue of politics right now. The former Georgia Congresswoman is running for the Green Party's presidential nomination. She isn't making much of a dent, though. The majority of the Green Party voters seem to prefer Ralph Nader. So, Rob, you had an article, Democrats Fear a Green Cynthia McKinney. Can you explain what you mean?
Well, I believe that the Democratic Party is invested in, of course, keeping people Democrats, especially people within the black community. That's a sizable constituent that they rely very heavily on. Being an independent myself, I've used to be a Democrat. I'm a recovering Democrat. and let me just say that I think that life in the independent world is very attractive to a lot of black people. Once they start to learn a little bit more about the independent movement, learn about leveraging our vote within government. So when you have someone like Cynthia McKinney, who is a recovering Democrat, who is now in the Green Party movement, giving Nader a run for his money, she's coming in a respectable second in California, and we look to her at some point to either win the nomination, especially if Nader decides not to run, or be a vice presidential pick for Nader, or maybe Nader will be her vice presidential pick. This could be an interesting scenario where people start to forget about Barack Obama and say, hey, wait a minute, there's another facet that we can consider here when we talk about Cynthia McKinney, who has been a champion of issues like COINTELPRO. She's also targeted the Bush administration. She was the first to author a bill to impeach the president of the United States.
Now, Nashika is here with me in our NPR West studios near Los Angeles, and she is clutching her head. Why?
I'm just respectfully, Rob, isn't that kind of a wishful thinking?
it might be, quote unquote, considered wishful thinking, especially if you're a member of the Democratic Party. But look, all I'm saying is that Cynthia McKinney has a respectable record and when it comes to issues. Now, she has some conduct that some people say is unbecoming of a legislator, and I'm not questioning that or saying that she doesn't. But what I'm saying is that she has been a champion of issues that some people call conspiracies or whatever. They have turned out to have some validity.
I'm just saying, given our process, that's all. I mean, I like Cynthia McKinney, and I like Ralph Nader, but given our process, our political process, just it's hopeful to coin a candidate.
Let me get Patrice in here.
Okay.
What do you think? I mean, is this something where she's actually going to build a base of support, Cynthia McKinney?
I mean, I don't know. I personally admire the independent candidates for offering alternative voices to, I mean, it's a system that seems to be broken. They're trying to throw in issues that really need to be discussed and analyzed, but I can't support her campaign. I'm backing Barack Obama. I mean, I don't know. I just think describing her as the perfect storm for the Democrats, which I think you did and the post that you wrote, it seems a little overstated. And I also realize that they're not getting as much media attention. I think that Cynthia McKinney, the indie candidates, might not fit into the script that the media has created for this particular electoral race.
I want to move on to one last thing, and that is sweet, sweet music. There were two major pop stars up for Album of the Year. Everyone was sure either Kanye West or Amy Winehouse would take the trophy, but the top prize at the Grammys went to a jazz artist. Remember jazz? Legendary pianist Herbie Hancock won for his disc River, the Joni Letters. Here's Hancock accepting his award last night.
It's been 43 years since the first and only time that a jazz artist got the Album of the Year award. And I'd like to thank the Academy for courageously breaking the mold this time. This is a new day that proves that the impossible can be made possible.
Patrice, I was just reading another article on how classical music has not fared well, according to some folks, in the Grammy Awards. But this is a big comeback for jazz. Is it something that folks should pay attention to who are maybe of the hip-hop and rock and roll sensibilities and plug back into jazz as a living, breathing art form?
I sure hope so. I think that I believe it was Vince Gill had a quote where he was saying that, you know, Herbie Hancock is probably one of the most accomplished musicians to have won a Grammy last night in the ceremony. I'm a big fan of hip-hop, and I love Kanye West, and I was kind of expecting Amy Winehouse to win, but I think it's great that hip-hop and those expectations would have to kind of enjoy some humble pie right now. And I really hope that this breathes fresh life and brings new interest to jazz, because it is the foundation.
Nishika, what are your musical tastes? Are they broad enough to encompass
yes.
the jazz? And,
yeah. Jazz, classical, hip-hop, pop, even some country.
Oh, boy. Mm. And when you look at these awards, do you put any faith in them?
No.
No.
This means nothing. I mean, first of all, Herbie Hancock looked fantastic. Pretty hot, just to change it for a second. But besides that, Herbie Hancock winning, all of this is kind of just, it's a gesture. It doesn't really mean much. You know, I think people like jazz and they'll continue to like jazz. I hadn't heard of this album. Maybe I'll listen to it now. It'll be good for sales for him, but does it mean anything in the big scheme? Nah.
Rob, I want to ask you about Barack Obama winning a Grammy. He's someone who did his audiobook of his latest memoir/political book, Audacity of Hope.
Right.
Is that significant?
Oh, of course it is. I mean, any win that Barack can get, I think he'll take it, especially, you know, the Democrats are very savvy here. They think that this is going to be the election where they can get a lot of people on the Democratic Party platform and supporting it. So this is going to be a big coup for him. If I can real quickly go right back to one thing that I was finishing before, is the left-right media that we have in this country that continues to perpetuate partisanship. They don't want to cover people like Cynthia McKinney, and they're not going to, and I don't expect them to. That's the reason why Reading News Review exists, and that's why we're from an independent perspective.
One last question that goes to the pop culture rather than the politics. Patrice, I was conversing online with a friend who is very versed in the hip-hop world, and she said that if you compare, you know, the Foo Fighters last night had this big orchestral situation, and Kanye chose to go out on stage alone, and she said, this is her opinion, that's why hip-hop shows are boring. She had a problem with the performance of hip-hop as opposed to the music itself. How is performance, having these different genres stack up against each other? Do you think hip-hop has mastered the art of live performance in these larger venues?
That's a really interesting question. I agree with her in a certain sense. Hip-hop, it's all about the ego and this one person kind of speaking directly into a microphone. And it is very, it can be boring. You know, I think Kanye did a good performance. I think he definitely thinks a lot about how he's going to present his music. But compared to the spectacle of the Foo Fighters performance, you know, it's difficult to compare those two and say which one was more entertaining.
All right. On that note, literally, we're going to have to wrap it up. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Patrice Elizabeth Grell-Yersick is the creator of AfroBella.com, and joined me from member station WLRN in Miami. Nashika Washington runs YourBlackFriend.com, and she is here at our NPR West studios. And Robert Redding publishes the ReddingNewsReview.com. Join me from the Radio People studios in Monroe, Louisiana.